as pearl, and the profusion of her sable tresses, which, each arranged in its own little spiral of twisted curls, fell down upon as much of a snow-white neck and bosom as a samar of the richest Persian silk, exhibiting flowers in their natural colours embossed upon a purple ground, permitted to be visible. All these constituted a combination of loveliness, which yielded not to the loveliest of the maidens who surrounded her. It is true that of the golden and pearl-studded clasps which closed her vest from the throat to the waist, the three uppermost were left unfastened on account of the heat, which something enlarged the prospect to which we allude. A diamond necklace, with pendants of inestimable value, were by this means also made more conspicuous. The feather of an ostrich, fastened in her turban by an agraffe set with brilliants, was another distinction of the beautiful Jewess, scoffed and sneered at by the proud dames who sat above her, but secretly envied by those who affected to deride them.
"By the bald scalp of Abraham," said Prince John, "yonder Jewess must be the very model of that perfection whose charms drove frantic the wisest king who ever lived. What sayst thou, Prior Aymer? By the temple, which my wiser brother Richard proved unable to recover, she is the very bride of the canticles."
"The Rose of Sharon and the Lily of the Valley," answered the prior in a sort of snuffling tone. "But your grace must remember she is still but a Jewess."
"Aye," added Prince John without heeding him, "and there is my mammon of unrighteousness too, the Marquis of Marks, the Baron of Byzance, contesting for place with penniless dogs whose threadbare cloaks have not a single cross in their pouches to keep the devil from dancing there. By the body of St. Mark, my Prince of Supplies, with his lovely Jewess, shall have a place in the gallery. What is she, Isaac? Thy wife or thy daughter, that eastern houri that thou lock'st under thy arm?"
"My daughter Rebecca, so please your grace," answered Isaac with a low congé, nothing embarrassed by the prince's salutation, in which, however, there was at least as much mockery as courtesy.
"The wiser man thou," said John with a peal of laughter,
in which his gay followers obsequiously joined.
"But daughter or wife, she should be preferred, according to her beauty and thy merits. Who sits above there?" he continued, bending his eye on the gallery. "Saxon churls, out upon them! Let them sit close and make room for my prince of usurers and his lovely daughter. I'll make the hinds know they must share the high places of the synagogue with those whom the synagogue properly belongs to."
Those who occupied the gallery to whom this injurious and unpolite speech was addressed were the family of Cedric the Saxon, with that of his ally and kinsman Athelstane of Coningsborough, a personage who, on account of his descent from the last Saxon monarchs of England, was held in the highest respect by all the Saxon natives of the north of England. But with the blood of this ancient royal race, many of their infirmities had descended to Athelstane. He was comely in countenance, bulky and strong in person, and in the flower of his age, yet inanimate in expression, dull-eyed, heavy-browed, inactive and sluggish in all his motions, and so slow in resolution that the sobriquet of one of his ancestors was conferred upon him, and he was very generally called Athelstane the Unready. His friends, and he had many, who as well as Cedric were passionately attached to him, contended that this sluggish temper arose not from want of courage, but from mere want of decision. Others alleged that his hereditary vice of drunkenness had obscured his faculties, never of a very acute order, and that the passive courage and meek good nature which remained behind were merely the dregs of a temper that might have been valuable, but of which all the valuable parts had flown off in the progress of a long course of brutal debauchery. It was to this person, such as we have described him, that the prince addressed his imperious command to make place for Isaac and Rebecca. Athelstane, utterly confounded at an order which the manners and feelings of the times held so injuriously insulting, unwilling to obey, yet undetermined how to resist, opposed only the vis inertiae to the will of John, and without stirring or making any motion whatsoever of obedience, opened his large grey eyes and stared at the prince with an astonishment which had in it something extremely ludicrous. But the impatient John regarded it in no such light.
"The Saxon porker," he said, "is either asleep or minds me not. Prick him with your lance, Brassy,"
speaking to a knight who rode near him, the leader of a band of free companions, or condottieri, that is, of mercenaries belonging to no particular nation, but attached for the time to any prince by whom they were paid. There was a murmur even among the attendants of Prince John, but Brassy, whose profession freed him from all scruples, extended his long lance over the space which separated the gallery from the lists, and would have executed the commands of the prince before Athelstane the Unready had recovered presence of mind sufficient even to draw back his person from the weapon, had not Cedric, as prompt as his companion was tardy, unsheathed with the speed of lightning the short sword which he wore, and at a single blow severed the point of the lance from the handle. The blood rushed into the countenance of Prince John. He swore one of his deepest oaths, and was about to utter some threat corresponding in violence, when he was diverted from his purpose, partly by his own attendants, who gathered around him, conjuring him to be patient, partly by a general exclamation of the crowd, uttered in loud applause of the spirited conduct of Cedric. The prince rolled his eyes in indignation, as if to select some safe and easy victim, and chancing to encounter the firm glance of the same archer whom we have already noticed, and who seemed to persist in his gesture of applause, in spite of the frowning aspect which the prince bent upon him, he demanded his reason for clamouring thus.
"I always add my hollow," said the yeoman, "when I see a good shot or a gallant blow."
"Sayst thou?" answered the prince.
"Then thou canst hit the white thyself, I'll warrant."
"A woodsman's mark, and at woodsman's distance I can hit," answered the yeoman.
"And what Tyrrell's mark at 100 yards?
Said a voice from behind, but by whom uttered could not be discerned. This allusion to the fate of William Rufus, his grandfather, at once incensed and alarmed Prince John. He satisfied himself, however, with commanding the men-at-arms who surrounded the lists to keep an eye on that braggart, pointing to the yeoman.
"By St. Grizzle," he added, "we will try his own skill, who is so ready to give his voice to the feats of others."
"I shall not fly the trial," said the yeoman, with the composure which marked his whole deportment.
"Meanwhile, stand up, you Saxon churls," said the fiery prince, "for by the light of heaven, since I have said it, the Jew shall have his seat amongst you."
"By no means, an it please your grace. It is not fit for such as us to sit with the rulers of the land," said the Jew, whose ambition for precedence, though it had led him to dispute place with the extenuated and impoverished descendant of the line of Montdidier, by no means urged him to an intrusion upon the privileges of the wealthy Saxons.
"Up, infidel dog, when I command you," said Prince John, "or I will have thy swarthy hide stripped off and tanned for horse furniture."
Thus urged, the Jew began to ascend the steep and narrow steps which led up to the gallery.
"Let me see," said the prince, "who dare stop him?"
fixing his eye on Cedric, whose attitude intimated his intention to hurl the Jew down headlong. The catastrophe was prevented by the clown Womba, who, springing betwixt his master and Isaac, and exclaiming in answer to the prince's defiance,
"Marry, that will I,"
opposed to the beard of the Jew a shield of brawn, which he plucked from beneath his cloak, and with which, doubtless, he had furnished himself, lest the tournament should have proved longer than his appetite could endure abstinence. Finding the abomination of his tribe opposed to his very nose, while the jester at the same time flourished his wooden sword above his head, the Jew recoiled, missed his footing, and rolled down the steps. An excellent jest to the spectators, who set up a loud laughter, in which Prince John and his attendants heartily joined.
"Deal me the prize, cousin prince," said Womba. "I have vanquished my foe in fair fight, with sword and shield," he added, brandishing the brawn in one hand and the wooden sword in the other.
"Ooh, and what art thou, noble champion?"
said Prince John, still laughing.
"A fool by right of descent," answered the jester.
I am Wamba, the son of Witless, who was the son of Weatherbrain, who was the son of an alderman.
Make room for the Jew in front of the lower ring,
said Prince John, not unwilling, perhaps, to seize an apology to desist from his original purpose.
To place the vanquished beside the victor were false heraldry.
Knave upon fool were worse, answered the jester, and Jew upon bacon worst of all.
Gramercy, good fellow, cried Prince John. Thou pleasest me. Here, Isaac, lend me a handful of byzants.
As the Jew, stunned by the request, afraid to refuse and unwilling to comply, fumbled in the furred bag which hung by his girdle, and was perhaps endeavouring to ascertain how few coins might pass for a handful, the prince stooped from his jennet and settled Isaac's doubts by snatching the pouch itself from his side, and flinging to Wamba a couple of the gold pieces which it contained, he pursued his career round the lists, leaving the Jew to the derision of those around him, and himself receiving as much applause from the spectators as if he had done some honest and honourable action. Chapter 8. At this, the challenger with fierce defy his trumpet sounds. The challenged makes reply. With clangour rings the field, resounds the vaulted sky, their visors closed, their lances in the rest, or at the helmet pointed, or the crest, they vanish from the barrier, speed the race, and spurring see decrease the middle space. Palamon and Arcite. In the midst of Prince John's cavalcade, he suddenly stopped, and, appealing to the prior of Jorvaux, declared the principal business of the day had been forgotten.
"By my halidom," said he, "we have forgotten, Sir Prior, to name the fair sovereign of love and of beauty, by whose white hand the palm is to be distributed. For my part, I am liberal in my ideas, and I care not if I give my vote for the black-eyed Rebecca."
"Holy Virgin," answered the prior, turning up his eyes in horror. "A Jewess? We should deserve to be stoned out of the lists, and I am not yet old enough to be a martyr. Besides, I swear by my patron saint that she is far inferior to the lovely Saxon, Rowena."
"Saxon or Jew," answered the prince, "Saxon or Jew, dog or hog, what matters it? I say, name Rebecca, were it only to mortify the Saxon churls."
A murmur arose, even among his own immediate attendants.
"This passes a jest, my lord," said Brassy. "No knight here will lay lance in rest if such an insult is attempted."
"It is the mere wantonness of insult," said one of the oldest of Prince John's followers, Waldemar Fitzurse, "and if your grace attempt it, cannot but prove ruinous to your projects."
"I entertained you, sir," said John, reining up his palfrey haughtily, "for my follower, but not for my counsellor."
"Those who follow your grace in the paths which you tread," said Waldemar, but speaking in a low voice, "acquire the right of counsellors, for your interest and safety are not more deeply gauged than theirs."
From the tone in which this was spoken, John saw the necessity of acquiescence.
"I did but jest," he said, "and you turn upon me like so many adders. Name whom you will in the fiend's name, and please yourselves."
"Nay, nay," said Brassy, "let the fair sovereign's throne remain unoccupied until the conqueror shall be named, and then let him choose the lady by whom it shall be filled. It will add another grace to his triumph, and teach fair ladies to prize the love of valiant knights, who can exalt them to such distinction."
"If Brian de Bois-Guilbert gain the prize," said the prior, "I will gauge my rosary that I name the sovereign of love and beauty."
"Bois-Guilbert," answered Brassy, "is a good lance, but there are others around these lists, Sir Prior, who will not fear to encounter him."
"Silence, sirs," said Waldemar, "and let the prince assume his seat. The knights and spectators are alike impatient. The time advances, and highly fit it is that the sport should commence."
Prince John, though not yet a monarch, had in Waldemar Fitzurse all the inconveniences of a favourite minister, who in serving his sovereign must always do so in his own way. He complied, however, although his disposition was precisely of that kind which is apt to be obstinate upon trifles, and assuming his throne, and being surrounded by his followers, gave signal to the heralds to proclaim the laws of the tournament, which were briefly as follows. First, the five challengers were to undertake all comers. Secondly, any knight proposing to combat might, if he pleased, select a special antagonist from among the challengers by touching his shield. If he did so with the reverse of his lance, the trial of skill was made with what were called the arms of courtesy, that is, lances at whose extremity a piece of round, flat board was fixed, so that no danger was encountered save from the shock of the horses and spears. But if the shield was touched with the sharp end of the lance, the combat was understood to be at outrance, that is, the knights were to fight with sharp weapons, as in actual battle. Thirdly, when the knights present had accomplished their vow, by each of them breaking five lances, the prince was to declare the victor in the first day's tourney, who should receive as prize a war-horse of exquisite beauty and matchless strength, and, in addition to this reward of valour, it was now announced he should have the peculiar honour of naming the Queen of Love and Beauty, by whom the prize should be given on the ensuing day. Fourthly, it was announced that, on the second day, there should be a general tournament in which all the knights present who were desirous to win praise might take part, and being divided into two bands of equal numbers, might fight it out manfully until the signal was given by Prince John to cease the combat. The elected Queen of Love and Beauty was then to crown the knight whom the prince should adjudge to have borne himself best in this second day with a coronet composed of thin gold plate cut into the shape of a laurel crown. On this second day, the knightly games ceased, but on that which followed, feats of archery, of bull-baiting, and other popular amusements were to be practised for the more immediate amusement of the populace. In this manner did Prince John endeavour to lay the foundation of a popularity which he was perpetually throwing down by some inconsiderate act of wanton aggression upon the feelings and prejudices of the people. The lists now presented a most splendid spectacle. The sloping galleries were crowded with all that was noble, great, wealthy, and beautiful in the northern and midland parts of England, and the contrast of the various dresses of these dignified spectators rendered the view as gay as it was rich, while the interior and lower space, filled with the substantial burgesses and yeomen of Merry England, formed in their more plain attire a dark fringe or border around this circle of brilliant embroidery, relieving and at the same time setting off its splendour. The heralds ceased their proclamation with their usual cry of "Largesse! Largesse, gallant knights!" and gold and silver pieces were showered on them from the galleries, it being a high point of chivalry to exhibit liberality towards those whom the age accounted the secretaries at once and historians of honour. The bounty of the spectators was acknowledged by the customary shouts of "Love of ladies! Death of champions! Honour to the generous! Glory to the brave!" to which the more humble spectators added their acclamations, and a numerous band of trumpeters the flourish of their martial instruments. When these sounds had ceased, the heralds withdrew from the lists in gay and glittering procession, and none remained within them save the marshals of the field, who, armed cap-a-pie, sat on horseback, motionless as statues, at the opposite ends of the lists. Meantime, the enclosed space at the northern extremity of the lists, large as it was now completely crowded with knights desirous to prove their skill against the challengers, and, when viewed from the galleries, presented the appearance of a sea of waving plumage, intermixed with glistening helmets and tall lances, to the extremities of which were, in many cases, attached small pennons of about a span's breadth, which, fluttering in the air as the breeze caught them, joined with the restless motion of the feathers to add liveliness to the scene. At length, the barriers were opened, and five knights, chosen by lot, advanced slowly into the area, a single champion riding in front, and the other four following in pairs. All were splendidly armed, and my Saxon authority, in the Wardour manuscript, records at great length their devices, their colours, and the embroidery of their horse trappings. It is unnecessary to be particular on these subjects. To borrow lines from a contemporary poet who has written but too little, "The knights are dust, and their good swords are rust. Their souls are with the saints, we trust." Their escutcheons have long mouldered from the walls of their castles. Their castles themselves are but green mounds and shattered ruins. The place that once knew them knows them no more. Nay, many a race since theirs has died out and been forgotten in the very land which they occupied, with all the authority of feudal proprietors and feudal lords. What then would it avail the reader to know their names, or the evanescent symbols of their martial rank? Now, however, no whit anticipating the oblivion which awaited their names and feats, the champions advanced through the lists, restraining their fiery steeds and compelling them to move slowly, while at the same time they exhibited their paces, together with the grace and dexterity of the riders. As the procession entered the lists, the sound of a wild, barbaric music was heard from behind the tents of the challengers, where the performers were concealed. It was of Eastern origin, having been brought from the Holy Land, and the mixture of the cymbals and bells seemed to bid welcome at once and defiance to the knights as they advanced. With the eyes of an immense concourse of spectators fixed upon them, the five knights advanced up to the platform upon which the tents of the challengers stood, and there, separating themselves, each touched slightly, and with the reverse of his lance, the shield of the antagonist to whom he wished to oppose himself. The lower orders of spectators in general, nay, many of the higher, and it is even said several of the ladies, were rather disappointed at the champions choosing the arms of courtesy. For the same sort of persons who, in the present day, applaud most highly the deepest tragedies, were then interested in a tournament exactly in proportion to the danger incurred by the champions engaged. Having intimated their more pacific purpose, the champions retreated to the extremity of the lists, where they remained drawn up in a line, while the challengers, sallying each from his pavilion, mounted their horses, and, headed by Brian de Bois-Guilbert, descended from the platform and opposed themselves individually to the knights who had touched their respective shields. At the flourish of clarions and trumpets, they started out against each other at full gallop, and such was the superior dexterity or good fortune of the challengers that those opposed to Bois-Guilbert, Malvoisin, and Front de Boeuf rolled on the ground. The antagonist of Grandmesnil, instead of bearing his lance-point fair against the crest or the shield of his enemy, swerved so much from the direct line as to break his weapon athwart the person of his opponent, a circumstance which was accounted more disgraceful than being actually unhorsed, because the one might happen from accident, whereas the other evinced awkwardness and want of management of the weapon and of the horse. The fifth knight alone maintained the honour of his party, and parted fairly with the Knight of St. John, both splintering their lances without advantage on either side. The shouts of the multitude, together with the acclamations of the heralds and the clangour of the trumpets, announced the triumph of the victors and the defeat of the vanquished. The former retreated to their pavilions, and the latter, gathering themselves up as they could, withdrew from the lists in disgrace and dejection, to agree with their victors concerning the redemption of their arms and their horses, which, according to the laws of the tournament, they had forfeited. The fifth of their number alone tarried in the lists long enough to be greeted with the applauses of the spectators, amongst which he retreated, to the aggravation, doubtless, of his companion's mortification. A second and a third party of knights took the field, and although they had various success, yet upon the whole the advantage decidedly remained with the challengers, not one of whom lost his seat or swerved from his charge, misfortunes which befell one or two of their antagonists in each encounter. The spirits, therefore, of those opposed to them seemed to be considerably damped by their continued success. Three knights only appeared on the fourth entry, who, avoiding the shields of Bois-Guilbert and Front de Boeuf, contented themselves with touching those of the three other knights, who had not altogether manifested the same strength and dexterity. This politic selection did not alter the luck of the field. The challengers were still successful, One of their antagonists was overthrown, and both the others failed in the atteint, that is, in striking the helmet and shield of their antagonist firmly and strongly, with the lance held in a direct line, so that the weapon might break, unless the champion was overthrown. After this fourth encounter, there was a considerable pause. Nor did it appear that anyone was very desirous of renewing the encounter. The spectators murmured among themselves, for among the challengers, Malvoisin and Front de Boeuf were unpopular from their characters, and the others, except Grandmesnil, as strangers and foreigners. But none shared the general feeling of dissatisfaction so keenly as Cedric the Saxon, who saw in each advantage gained by the Norman challengers a repeated triumph over the honour of England. His own education had taught him no skill in the games of chivalry, although with the arms of his Saxon ancestors he had manifested himself on many occasions a brave and determined soldier. He looked anxiously to Athelstane, who had learned the accomplishments of the age, as if desiring that he should make some personal effort to recover the victory which was passing into the hands of the Templar and his associates. But though both stout of heart and strong of person, Athelstane had a disposition too inert and unambitious to make the exertions which Cedric seemed to expect from him.
"The day is against England, my lord," said Cedric in a marked tone. "Are you not tempted to take the lance?"
"I shall tilt tomorrow," answered Athelstane. "In the melee, it is not worthwhile to arm myself today."
Two things displeased Cedric in this speech. It contained the Norman word melee to express the general conflict, and it evinced some indifference to the honour of the country. But it was spoken by Athelstane, whom he held in such profound respect that he would not trust himself to canvass his motives or his foibles. Moreover, he had no time to make any remark, for Wamba thrust in his word, observing,
"It was better to be the best man among 100 than the best man of 2.
Athelstane took the observation as a serious compliment, but Cedric, who better understood the jester's meaning, darted at him a severe and menacing look. And lucky it was for the jester, perhaps, that the time and place prevented his receiving, notwithstanding his place in service, more sensible marks of his master's resentment. The pause in the tournament was still uninterrupted, excepting by the voices of the heralds exclaiming,
"Love of ladies! Splintering of lances! Stand forth, gallant knights! Fair eyes look upon your deeds!"
The music also of the challengers breathed from time to time wild bursts expressive of triumph or defiance, while the clowns grudged a holiday which seemed to pass away in inactivity, and old knights and nobles lamented in whispers the decay of martial spirit, spoke of the triumph of their younger days, but agreed that the land did not now supply dames of such transcendent beauty as had animated the jousts of former times. Prince John began to talk to his attendants about making ready the banquet and the necessity of adjudging the prize to Brian de Bois-Guilbert, who had, with a single spear, overthrown 2 knights and foiled a 3rd. At length, as the Saracenic music of the challengers concluded one of those long and high flourishes with which they had broken the silence of the lists, it was answered by a solitary trumpet, which breathed a note of defiance from the northern extremity. All eyes were turned to see the new champion which these sounds announced, and no sooner were the barriers opened than he paced into the lists. As far as could be judged of a man sheathed in armour, the new adventurer did not greatly exceed the middle size, and seemed to be rather slender than strongly made. His suit of armour was formed of steel, richly inlaid with gold, and the device on his shield was a young oak tree pulled up by the roots, with the Spanish word desdichado, signifying disinherited. He was mounted on a gallant black horse, and as he passed through the lists, he gracefully saluted the prince and the ladies by lowering his lance. The dexterity with which he managed his horse, and something of youthful grace which he displayed in his manner, won him the favour of the multitude, which some of the lower classes expressed by crying,
"Touch Ralph de Vipon's shield! Touch the hospitaller's shield! He has the least sure seat! He is your cheapest bargain!"
The champion, moving onward amid these well-meant hints, ascended the platform by the sloping alley which led to it from the lists, and, to the astonishment of all present, riding straight up to the central pavilion, struck with the sharp end of his spear the shield of Brion de Bois-Guilbert until it rung again. All stood astonished at his presumption, but none more than the redoubted knight whom he had thus defied to mortal combat.
"Have you confessed yourself, brother?" said the Templar. "And have you heard mass this morning that you peril your life so frankly?"
"I am fitter to meet death than thou art," answered the disinherited knight, for by this name the stranger had recorded himself in the books of the tourney.
"Then take your place in the lists," said de Bois-Guilbert, "and look your last upon the sun, for this night thou shalt sleep in paradise."
"Gramercy for thy courtesy," replied the disinherited knight, "and to requite it, I advise thee to take a fresh horse and a new lance, for by my honour you will need both." Having expressed himself thus confidently, he reined his horse backwards down the slope which he had ascended, and compelled him in the same manner to move backwards through the lists till he reached the northern extremity, where he remained stationary, in expectation of his antagonist. This feat of horsemanship again attracted the applause of the multitude. However incensed at his adversary for the precautions which he recommended, Brion de Bois-Guilbert did not neglect his advice, for his honour was too nearly concerned to permit his neglecting any means which might ensure victory over his presumptuous opponent. He changed his horse for a fresh one of great strength and spirit. He chose a new and tough spear, lest the wood of the former might have been strained in the previous encounters he had sustained. Lastly, he laid aside his shield, which had received some little damage, and received another from his squires. His first had only borne the general device of his order, representing two knights riding upon one horse, an emblem expressive of the original humility and poverty of the Templars, qualities which they had since exchanged for the arrogance and wealth that finally occasioned their suppression. Bois-Guilbert's new shield bore a raven in full flight, holding in its claws a skull and bearing the motto, "Garde le Corbeau." When the two champions stood opposed to each other at the two extremities of the lists, the public expectation was strained to the highest pitch. Few augured the possibility that the encounter could terminate well for the disinherited knight, yet his courage and gallantry secured the general good wishes of the spectators. The trumpets had no sooner given the signal than the champions vanished from their posts with the speed of lightning and closed in the centre of the lists with the shock of a thunderbolt. The lances burst into shivers up to the very grasp, and it seemed at the moment that both knights had fallen, for the shock had made each horse recoil backwards upon its hams. The address of the riders recovered their steeds by use of the bridle and spur, and having glared on each other for an instant with eyes which seemed to flash fire through the bars of their visors, each made a demi-volte, and retiring to the extremity of the lists, received a fresh lance from the attendants. A loud shout from the spectators, waving of scarves and handkerchiefs, and general acclamations attested the interest taken by the spectators in this encounter, the most equal as well as the best performed which had graced the day. But no sooner had the knights resumed their station than the clamour of applause was hushed into a silence, so deep and so dead that it seemed the multitude were afraid even to breathe. A few minutes' pause having been allowed, that the combatants and their horses might recover breath, Prince John, with his truncheon, signed to the trumpets to sound the onset. The champions a second time sprung from their stations and closed in the centre of the lists with the same speed, the same dexterity, the same violence, but not the same equal fortune as before. In this second encounter, the Templar aimed at the centre of his antagonist's shield and struck it so fair and forcibly that his spear went to shivers and the disinherited knight reeled in his saddle. On the other hand, that champion had, in the beginning of his career, directed the point of his lance towards Bois-Guilbert's shield, but, changing his aim almost in the moment of encounter, he addressed it to the helmet, a mark more difficult to hit, but which, if attained, rendered the shock more irresistible. Yet, even at this disadvantage, the Templar sustained his high reputation, and had not the girths of his saddle burst, he might not have been unhorsed. As it chanced, however, saddle, horse, and man rolled on the ground under a cloud of dust. To extricate himself from the stirrups and fallen steed was to the Templar scarce the work of a moment, and stung with madness, both at his disgrace and at the acclamations with which it was hailed by the spectators, he drew his sword and waved it in defiance of his conqueror. The Disinherited Knight sprung from his steed and also unsheathed his sword. The marshals of the field, however, spurred their horses between them and reminded them that the laws of the tournament did not, on the present occasion, permit this species of encounter.
"We shall meet again, I trust,"
said the Templar, casting a resentful glance at his antagonist,
"and where there are none to separate us."
"If we do not," said the Disinherited Knight, "the fault shall not be mine. On foot or horseback, with spear, with axe, or with sword, I am alike ready to encounter thee."
More and angrier words would have been exchanged, but the marshals, crossing their lances betwixt them, compelled them to separate. The Disinherited Knight returned to his first station, and Bois Guilbert to his tent, where he remained for the rest of the day in an agony of despair. Without alighting from his horse, the conqueror called for a bowl of wine, and opening the beaver, or lower part of his helmet, announced that he quaffed it to all true English hearts, and to the confusion of foreign tyrants. He then commanded his trumpet to sound a defiance to the challengers, and desired a herald to announce to them that he should make no election, but was willing to encounter them in the order in which they pleased to advance against him. The gigantic Front de Boeuf, armed in sable armour, was the first who took the field. He bore on a white shield a black bull's head, half defaced by the numerous encounters which he had undergone, and bearing the arrogant motto, "Cave Adsum." Over this champion the Disinherited Knight obtained a slight but decisive advantage. Both champions broke their lances fairly, but Front de Boeuf, who lost a stirrup in the encounter, was adjudged to have the disadvantage. In the stranger's third encounter with Sir Philip de Malvoisin, he was equally successful, striking that baron so forcibly on the casque that the laces of the helmet broke, and Malvoisin, only saved from falling by being unhelmed, was declared vanquished like his companions. In his fourth encounter with de Grandmesnil, the Disinherited Knight showed as much courtesy as he had hitherto evinced courage and dexterity. De Grandmesnil's horse, which was young and violent, reared and plunged in the course of the career so as to disturb the rider's aim, and the stranger, declining to take the advantage which this accident afforded him, raised his lance, and passing his antagonist without touching him, wheeled his horse and rode again to his own end of the lists, offering his antagonist, by a herald, the chance of a second encounter. This de Grandmesnil declined, avowing himself vanquished as much by the courtesy as by the address of his opponent. Ralph de Vipont summed up the list of the stranger's triumphs, being hurled to the ground with such force that the blood gushed from his nose and his mouth, and he was borne senseless from the lists. The acclamations of thousands applauded the unanimous award of the prince and marshals, announcing that day's honours to the Disinherited Knight. Chapter 9. In the midst was seen a lady of a more majestic mien, by stature and by beauty marked their sovereign queen. And as in beauty she surpassed the choir, so nobler than the rest was her attire. A crown of ruddy gold enclosed her brow, plain without pomp, and rich without a show. A branch of Agnus Castus in her hand, she bore aloft her symbol of command. The flower and the leaf. William de Wivel and Stephen de Martival, the marshals of the field, were the first to offer their congratulations to the victor, praying him at the same time to suffer his helmet to be unlaced, or at least that he would raise his visor ere they conducted him to receive the prize of the day's tourney from the hands of Prince John. The Disinherited Knight, with all knightly courtesy, declined their request, alleging that he could not at this time suffer his face to be seen for reasons which he had assigned to the heralds when he entered the lists. The marshals were perfectly satisfied with this reply, for amidst the capricious vows by which knights were accustomed to bind themselves in those days of chivalry, there was none more common than those by which they engaged to remain incognito for a certain space, or until some particular adventure was achieved. The marshals, therefore, pressed no farther into the mystery of the Disinherited Knight, but announcing to Prince John the Conqueror's desire to remain unknown, they requested permission to bring him before his grace, in order that he might receive the reward of his valour. John's curiosity was excited by the mystery observed by the stranger, and, being already displeased with the issue of the tournament, in which the challengers whom he favoured had been successively defeated by one knight, he answered haughtily to the marshals, "By the light of Our Lady's brow, this same knight has been disinherited, as well of his courtesy as of his lands, since he desires to appear before us without uncovering his face. Watch him, my lords," he said, turning round to his train, "who this gallant can be that bears himself thus proudly?" "I cannot guess," answered de Bracy, "nor did I think there had been within the four seas that girth Britain a champion that could bear down these five knights in one day's jousting. By my faith, I shall never forget the force with which he shocked de Vipont. The poor Hospitaller was hurled from his saddle like a stone from a sling."
"Boast not of that," said a knight of St. John, who was present. "Your Temple champion had no better luck. I saw Bois Guilbert roll thrice over, grasping his hands full of sand at every turn."
Bracy, being attached to the Templars, would have replied, but was prevented by Prince John.
"Silence, sirs," he said. "What unprofitable debate have we here?"
"The victor," said de Wyvil, "still waits the pleasure of your highness."
"It is our pleasure," answered John, "that he do so wait until we learn whether there is not someone who can at least guess at his name and quality. Should he remain there till night, he has had work enough to keep him warm."
"Your grace," said Waldemar Fitzurse, "will do less than due honour to the victor if you compel him to wait till we tell your highness that which we cannot know. At least I can form no guess, unless he be one of the good lances who accompanied King Richard, and who are now straggling homeward from the Holy Land."
"It may be the Earl of Salisbury," said Bracy. "He is about the same pitch."
"Sir Thomas de Malton, the Knight of Gisland, rather," said Fitzurse. "Salisbury is bigger in the bones."
A whisper arose among the train, but by whom first suggested could not be ascertained.
"It might be the king. It might be Richard Coeur de Lion himself."
"Over God's forebode," said
Prince John, involuntarily turning at the same time as pale as death, and shrinking as if blighted by a flash of lightning.
"Waldemar, Bracy, brave knights and gentlemen, remember your promises and stand truly by me."
"Here is no danger impending," said Waldemar Fitzurse. "Are you so little acquainted with the gigantic limbs of your father's son as to think they can be held within the circumference of yonder suit of armour? De Wyvil and de Martevel, you will best serve the prince by bringing forward the victor to the throne and ending an error that has conjured all the blood from his cheeks. Look at him more closely," he continued. "Your highness will see that he wants 3 inches of King Richard's height, and twice as much of his shoulder breadth. The very horse he backs could not have carried King Richard through a single course."
While he was yet speaking, the marshals brought forward the Disinherited Knight to the foot of a wooden flight of steps, which formed the ascent from the lists to Prince John's throne. Still discomposed with the idea that his brother, so much injured, and to whom he was so much indebted, had suddenly arrived in his native kingdom, even the distinctions pointed out by Fitzurse did not altogether remove the prince's apprehensions. And while, with a short and embarrassed eulogy upon his valour, he caused to be delivered to him the war horse assigned as the prize, he trembled lest from the barred visor of the mailed form before him an answer might be returned in the deep and awful accents of Richard the Lion-hearted. But the Disinherited Knight spoke not a word in reply to the compliment of the prince, which he only acknowledged by a profound obeisance. The horse was led into the lists by two grooms, richly dressed, the animal itself being fully accoutred with the richest war furniture, which, however, scarcely added to its value in the eyes of those who were judges. Laying one hand upon the pommel of the saddle, the Disinherited Knight vaulted at once upon the back of the steed without making use of the stirrup, and, brandishing aloft his lance, rode twice around the lists, exhibiting the points and paces of the animal with the skill of a perfect horseman. The appearance of vanity, which might otherwise have been attributed to this display, was removed by the propriety shown in exhibiting to the best advantage the princely reward with which he had been just honoured, and the knight was again greeted by the acclamations of all present. In the meanwhile, the bustling prior of Jorvaux had reminded Prince John, in a whisper, that the victor must now display his good judgment instead of his valour by selecting from among the beauties who graced the galleries a lady who should fill the throne of the Queen of Beauty and of Love, and deliver the prize of the tourney upon the ensuing day. The prince accordingly made a sign with his truncheon as the knight passed him in his second career around the lists. The knight turned towards the throne, and, sinking his lance until the point was within a foot of the ground, remained motionless, as if expecting John's commands, while all admired the sudden dexterity with which he instantly reduced his fiery steed from a state of violent motion and high excitation to the stillness of an equestrian statue.
"Sir Disinherited Knight," said Prince John, "since that is the only title by which we can address you, it is now your duty, as well as privilege, to name the fair lady who, as Queen of Honour and of Love, is to preside over next day's festival. If, as a stranger in our land, you should require the aid of other judgment to guide your own, we can only say that Alicia, daughter of our gallant knight Waldemar Fitzurse, has at our court been long held the first in beauty as in place. Nevertheless, it is your undoubted prerogative to confer on whom you please this crown, by the delivery of which to the lady of your choice the election of tomorrow's queen will be formal and complete. Raise your lance."
The knight obeyed, and Prince John placed upon its point a coronet of green satin, having around its edge a circlet of gold, the upper edge of which was relieved by arrow points and hearts placed interchangeably, like the strawberry leaves and balls upon a ducal crown. In the broad hint which he dropped respecting the daughter of Waldemar Fitzurse, John had more than one motive, each the offspring of a mind which was a strange mixture of carelessness and presumption with low artifice and cunning. He wished to banish from the minds of the chivalry around him his own indecent and unacceptable jest respecting the Jewess Rebecca. He was desirous of conciliating Alicia's father, Waldemar, of whom he stood in awe, and who had more than once shown himself dissatisfied during the course of the day's proceedings. He had also a wish to establish himself in the good graces of the lady, for John was at least as licentious in his pleasures as profligate in his ambition. But besides all these reasons, he was desirous to raise up against the Disinherited Knight, towards whom he already entertained a strong dislike, a powerful enemy in the person of Waldemar Fitzurse, who was likely, he thought, highly to resent the injury done to his daughter, in case, as was not unlikely, the victor should make another choice. And so, indeed, it proved. For the Disinherited Knight passed the gallery close to that of the prince, in which the Lady Alicia was seated in the full pride of triumphant beauty, and, pacing forwards as slowly as he had hitherto rode swiftly around the lists, he seemed to exercise his right of examining the numerous fair faces which adorned that splendid circle. It was worthwhile to see the different conduct of the beauties who underwent this examination during the time it was going forward. Some blushed, some assumed an air of pride and dignity, Some looked straightforward and essayed to seem utterly unconscious of what was going on. Some endeavoured to forbear smiling, and there were two or three who laughed outright. There were also some who dropped their veils over their charms. But, as the Wardour manuscript says these were beauties of 10 years' standing, it may be supposed that, having had their full share of such vanities, they were willing to withdraw their claim in order to give a fair chance to the rising beauties of the age. At length the champion paused beneath the balcony in which the Lady Rowena was placed, and the expectation of the spectators was excited to the utmost. It must be owned that if an interest displayed in his success could have bribed the disinherited knight, the part of the lists before which he paused had merited his predilection. Cedric the Saxon, overjoyed at the discomfiture of the Templar, and still more so at the miscarriage of his two malevolent neighbours, Front de Boeuf and Malvoisin, had, with half his body stretched over the balcony, accompanied the victor in each course, not with his eyes only, but with his whole heart and soul. The Lady Rowena had watched the progress of the day with equal attention, though without betraying the same intense interest. Even the unmoved Athelstane had shown symptoms of shaking off his apathy when, calling for a huge goblet of muscadine, he quaffed it to the health of the disinherited knight. Another group, stationed under the gallery occupied by the Saxons, had shown no less interest in the fate of the day.
"Father Abraham," said Isaac of York, when the first course was run betwixt the Templar and the disinherited knight, "how fiercely that Gentile rides! Ah, the good horse that was brought all the long way from Barbary, he takes no more care of him than if he were a wild ass's colt, and the noble armour that was worth so many sequins to Joseph Pereira, the armourer of Milan, besides 70 in the 100 of profits, he cares for it as little as if he had found it in the highways."
"If he risks his own person and limbs, father," said Rebecca, "in doing such a dreadful battle, he can scarce be expected to save his horse and armour."
"Child," replied Isaac, somewhat heated, "thou knowest not what thou speakest. His neck and limbs are his own, but his horse and armour belong to... Holy Jacob, what was I about to say? Nevertheless, it is a good youth. See, Rebecca, see, he is again about to go up to battle against the Philistine. Pray, child, pray for the safety of the good youth, and of the speedy horse, and the rich armour. God of my fathers," he again exclaimed, "he hath conquered, and the uncircumcised Philistine hath fallen before his lance, even as Og, the king of Bashan, and Sion, king of the Amorites, fell before the sword of our fathers. Surely he shall take their gold and their silver and their war horses and their armour of brass and of steel for a prey and for a spoil."
The same anxiety did the worthy Jew display during every course that was run, seldom failing to hazard a hasty calculation concerning the value of the horse and armour which was forfeited to the champion upon each new success. There had been, therefore, no small interest taken in the success of the disinherited knight by those who occupied the part of the lists before which he now paused. Whether from indecision or some other motive of hesitation, the champion of the day remained stationary for more than a minute, while the eyes of the silent audience were riveted upon his motions, and then, gradually and gracefully sinking the point of his lance, he deposited the coronet which it supported at the feet of the fair Rowena. The trumpets instantly sounded, while the heralds proclaimed the Lady Rowena the queen of beauty and of love for the ensuing day, menacing with suitable penalties those who should be disobedient to her authority. They then repeated their cry of largesse, to which Cedric, in the height of his joy, replied by an ample donative, and to which Athelstane, though less promptly, added one equally large. There was some murmuring among the damsels of Norman descent, who were as much unused to see the preference given to a Saxon beauty as the nobles were to sustain defeat in the games of chivalry which they themselves had introduced. But these sounds of disaffection were drowned by the popular shout of "Long live the Lady Rowena, the chosen and lawful queen of love and of beauty," to which many added, "Long live the Saxon princess!
Long live the race of the immortal Alfred!
However unacceptable these sounds might be to Prince John and to those around him, he saw himself nevertheless obliged to confirm the nomination of the victor, and accordingly, calling to horse, he left his throne and, mounting his jennet, accompanied by his train, he again entered the lists. The prince paused a moment beneath the gallery of the Lady Alicia, to whom he paid his compliments, observing at the same time to those around him,
"By my halidome, sirs, if the knight's feats in arms have shown that he hath limbs and sinews, his choice hath no less proved that his eyes are none of the clearest."
It was on this occasion, as during his whole life, John's misfortune not perfectly to understand the characters of those whom he wished to conciliate. Waldemar Fitzurse was rather offended than pleased at the prince stating thus broadly an opinion that his daughter had been slighted.
"I know no right of chivalry," he said, "more precious or inalienable than that of each free knight to choose his lady love by his own judgment. My daughter courts distinction from no one, and in her own character and in her own sphere will never fail to receive the full proportion of that which is her due."
Prince John replied not, but spurring his horse, as if to give vent to his vexation, he made the animal bound forward to the gallery where Rowena was seated, with the crown still at her feet.
"Assume," he said, "fair lady, the mark of your sovereignty, to which none vows homage more sincerely than ourself, and if it please you today, with your noble sire and friends, to grace our banquet in the castle of Ashby, we shall learn to know the Empress to whose service we devote tomorrow."
Rowena remained silent, and Cedric answered for her in his native Saxon.
"The Lady Rowena," he said, "possesses not the language in which to reply to your courtesy, or to sustain her part in your festival. I also, and the noble Athelstane of Coningsborough, speak only the language and practice only the manners of our fathers. We therefore decline, with thanks, your courteous invitation to the banquet. Tomorrow, the Lady Rowena will take upon her the state to which she has been called by the free election of the victor knight, confirmed by the acclamations of the people."
So saying, he lifted the coronet and placed it upon Rowena's head, in token of her acceptance of the temporary authority assigned to her.
"What says he?"
said Prince John, affecting not to understand the Saxon language, in which, however, he was well skilled. The purport of Cedric's speech was repeated to him in French.
"It is well," he said. "Tomorrow we will ourselves conduct this mute sovereign to her seat of dignity. You, at least, Sir Knight," he added, turning to the victor, who had remained near the gallery, "will this day share our banquet."
The knight, speaking for the first time in a low and hurried voice, excused himself by pleading fatigue and the necessity of preparing for tomorrow's encounter.
"It is well," said Prince John haughtily. "Although unused to such refusals, we will endeavour to digest our banquet as we may, though ungraced by the most successful in arms and his elected Queen of Beauty."
So saying, he left the lists with his glittering train, and his departure was the signal for the breaking up and dispersion of the spectators. Yet, with the vindictive memory proper to offended pride, especially when combined with conscious want of desert, John had hardly proceeded 3 paces, turning around, he fixed an eye of stern resentment upon the yeoman who had displeased him in the early part of the day, and issued his commands to the men-at-arms who stood near.
"On your life, suffer not that fellow to escape."
The yeoman stood the angry glance of the prince with the same unvaried steadiness which had marked his former deportment, saying with a smile,
"I have no intention to leave Ashby until the day after tomorrow. I must see how Staffordshire and Leicestershire can draw their bows. Needwood and Charnwood must rear good archers." "Aye," said Prince John to his attendants, but not in direct reply, "I will see how he can draw his own, and woe betide him unless his skill should prove some apology for his insolence."
"It is full time," said Brassy, that the outrecuidance of these peasants should be restrained by some striking example. Waldemar Fitzurse, who probably thought his patron was not taking the readiest road to popularity, shrugged up his shoulders and was silent. Prince John resumed his retreat from the lists, and the dispersion of the multitude became general. In various routes, according to the different quarters from which they came, and in groups of various numbers, the spectators were seen retreating over the plain. By far the most numerous part streamed towards the town of Ashby, where many of the distinguished persons were lodged in the castle, and where others found accommodation in the town itself. Among these were most of the knights who had already appeared in the tournament, or who proposed to fight there the ensuing day, and who, as they rode slowly along, talking over the events of the day, were greeted with loud shouts by the populace. The same acclamations were bestowed upon Prince John, although he was indebted for them rather to the splendour of his appearance and train than to the popularity of his character. A more sincere and more general, as well as a better merited acclamation, attended the victor of the day, until, anxious to withdraw himself from popular notice, he accepted the accommodation of one of those pavilions pitched at the extremities of the lists, the use of which was courteously tendered him by the marshals of the field. Upon his retiring to his tent, many who had lingered in the lists to look upon and form conjectures concerning him also dispersed. The signs and sounds of a tumultuous concourse of men lately crowded together in one place and agitated by the same passing events were now exchanged for the distant hum of voices of different groups retreating in all directions, and these speedily died away in silence. No other sounds were heard, save the voices of the menials who stripped the galleries of their cushions and tapestry in order to put them in safety for the night, and wrangled among themselves for the half-used bottles of wine and relics of the refreshments which had been served round to the spectators. Beyond the precincts of the lists, more than one forge was erected, and these now began to glimmer through the twilight, announcing the toil of the armourers, which was to continue through the whole night, in order to repair or alter the armour which was to be used tomorrow. A strong guard of men-at-arms, which was renewed at intervals from 2 hours to 2 hours, surrounded the lists and kept watch during the night. Chapter 10. Thus, like the sad presaging raven that tolls the sick man's passport in a hollow beak, and in the shadow of the silent night doth shake contagion from her sable wings, vexed and tormented runs poor Barabbas with fatal curses towards these Christians. Jew of Malta. The disinherited knight had no sooner reached his pavilion than squires and pages in abundance tendered their services to disarm him, to bring fresh attire, and to offer him the refreshment of the bath. Their zeal on this occasion was perhaps sharpened by curiosity, since everyone desired to know who the knight was that had gained so many laurels, yet had refused to lift his visor or to name his name. But their officious inquisitiveness was not gratified. The disinherited knight refused all other assistance save that of his own squire, or rather yeoman, a clownish-looking man who, wrapped in a cloak of dark-coloured felt, and having his head and face half buried in a Norman bonnet made of black fur, seemed to affect the incognito as much as his master. All others being excluded from the tent, this attendant relieved his master from the more burthensome parts of his armour and placed food and wine before him, which the exertions of the day had rendered very acceptable. He had scarcely finished a hasty meal ere his menial announced to him that 5 men, each leading a barbed steed, desired to speak with him. The disinherited knight had exchanged his armour for the long robe usually worn by those of his condition, which, being furnished with a hood, concealed the features, when such was the pleasure of the wearer, almost as completely as the visor of the helmet itself. But the twilight, which was now fast darkening, would of itself have rendered a disguise unnecessary, unless to persons to whom the face of an individual chanced to be particularly well known. The disinherited knight, therefore, stepped boldly forth to the front of his tent, and found the squires of the challengers, whom he easily knew by their russet and black dresses, each of whom led his master's charger, loaded with the armour in which he had that day fought.
"According to the laws of chivalry," said the foremost of these men, "I, Baldwin de Oily, squire to the redoubted knight Brian de Bois-Guilbert, make offer to you, styling yourself the disinherited knight, of the horse and armour used by the said Brian de Bois-Guilbert in this day's passage of arms, leaving it with your nobleness to retain or to ransom the same, according to your pleasure, for such is the law of arms." The other squires repeated nearly the same formula, and then stood